The Romantic Period. Part of the first movement of Beethoven's Fifth Piano Concerto in E-flat, The Emperor, written in 1809. Beethoven died in March 1827 in Vienna. He was 56. The last of the great classical composers, he was also the first of the Romantics. And it's from his death that we conveniently date the start of the Romantic movement in music. Beethoven had broken just about every rule, and no one who lived after him could be anything but aware of his legacy. Not only did he change the face of music, he changed its image. He had started the cult of the composer as individual, refusing to accept that the composer was subservient to his patron, as it was for Mozart only some 15 years earlier. The creative artist, Beethoven had shown, was above all that. Music should be made for music's sake. This was to become a cornerstone of the Romantic creed. Romanticism started towards the end of the 18th century as a literary concept, and was more of an attitude of mind than an actual code. Romantics rejected the supposedly cold, intellectual, logical approach of the classical period. Instead, they trusted in the instinctive truth of their own emotions. No longer did rules circumscribe what could be achieved. Music had meaning. The 19th century in Europe was an era of enormous progress, especially in science. Steam engines were invented, and railways began to crisscross the landscape. Industry became paramount. The men who became the pillars of 19th century society were the new men, the bankers, the politicians, the generals, the industrialists. Few had time for music unless it was for a ceremonial occasion. The old relationship between the artist and his patron vanished. The artist was now an outsider, a rebel. He was invariably a virtuoso performer, and he could also be a showman, a personality. No longer required simply to turn out notes by the yard as the result of a commission, he could write to please only himself. That meant looking inwards for inspiration. His feelings, his thoughts became paramount. Life was art, and art was life. Part of the movement known as the Witch's Sabbath, from the Symphonie Fantastique by Hector Berlioz. It's hard to believe that this wild, emotional, intensely personal music was written only 3 years after Beethoven's death. It seems to belong to a different age entirely. There can be no doubt that Berlioz intended the piece to have meaning, since he subtitled it Episode in the Life of an Artist, and wrote program notes that make it quite clear he was writing about his feelings for an Irish actress named Harriet Smithson. Berlioz was born near Grenoble in 1803. He arrived in Paris when he was 18 to study medicine, so that, like his father, he could become a doctor and take over the family practice. But his father had made the great mistake of giving his son a flute as a child, and ever since, young Hector had wanted to be a musician. Berlioz decided to give up medicine and enrolled as a part-time student at the Conservatoire, where he began to compose. He was one of the pioneers of the Romantic movement. With works like the Symphonie Fantastique, he introduced the idea of the program symphony and the idée fixe, or fixed idea, a musical theme associated with a person or idea, which is repeated throughout the work, but varied as the dramatic shape of each movement requires. This particular device was later taken up by Wagner, with his use of leitmotifs. Berlioz also began a passion for the works of Shakespeare, a common source of inspiration for Romantic composers, just as the works of Goethe were. In Berlioz's compositions, these passions found expression in such pieces as his Romeo and Juliet symphony, his King Lear overture, and the choral work, The Damnation of Faust. His operatic output included the massive Les Troyennes, The Trojans, and Benvenuto Cellini, based on the life of the Renaissance artist. Another important program symphony was the four-movement Harold in Italy, which began life as a viola concerto for Paganini and was originally intended to be a sequel to the Symphonie Fantastique. These were big works conceived on a grand scale, in which Berlioz could let his imagination run riot. And it was in the orchestration of these compositions that Berlioz was perhaps to have the greatest influence on subsequent composers. He loved large forces. His Requiem calls for over 200 voices, with a preference for 700 or 800. His ideal orchestra included 240 string instruments, 30 grand pianos, 30 harps, and comparable wind and percussion. This wasn't simply to make a huge noise. It was to create color in the orchestra in a way no composer, not even Beethoven, had before. Despite the large forces he employed, Berlioz often scored his works in the style of a chamber group, discovering the tiniest nuances in the sound. Although many considered him to be a showy charlatan, whose sanity was seriously in doubt, Berlioz was to have a profound effect on many later composers, especially on Liszt, Wagner, and Richard Strauss, who welcomed the freedom he gave them to create new sounds in the orchestra. From one end of the scale to the other, Schubert Lieder. That was Seligkeit, happiness. While Romantic composers generally preferred the large scale work, one area of the miniature that appealed to them enormously was song. Poetry had inspired the Romantic movement in the first place, and poetry allied to music, in other words song, provided just the sort of intense, personal statement the Romantics were after. The first great songwriter was the Austrian composer Franz Schubert. Like Beethoven, Schubert straddled the classical and romantic periods. In fact, he died in 1828, a year after Beethoven, at the tragically early age of 31. What Schubert might have written had he lived longer is one of music's great imponderables. As it is, he left behind over 600 songs, 15 string quartets, piano pieces, chamber works, and a considerable body of larger scale works, including 9 operas, 9 symphonies, and 6 masses, most of which were unperformed during his lifetime. Although it wasn't recognized or even known about at the time, Schubert was one of the most versatile of the great composers. Was he a classical or a romantic composer? Certainly his music was rooted in classical tradition, but his heart was clearly romantic. By the time his music began to be discovered, more than 30 years after his death, devices which would have struck the world as new and original had become commonplace. Schubert was born in Vienna in 1797 and felt very much under the shadow of Beethoven, who was nearly 30 years his senior. Secretly, in my heart of hearts, I still hope to make something of myself, but who can do anything after Beethoven? He once complained to a friend. Schubert was an extremely fast worker, but that alone would not make him a great composer. What really marked him out was his gift for melody. Fourth movement, the theme and five variations of Schubert's piano quintet in A major, better known as the Trout. Schubert's output, perhaps inevitably, with someone who worked at such speed and failed to recognize pieces of his own music when put in front of him, was uneven. But it is often intensely personal. Unable to get a permanent musical position, he refused to teach and had to be supported by friends. This led to frequent bouts of melancholia, which are reflected in some of his music. His Eighth Symphony, in particular, is intensely personal. This is the work known as the Unfinished. Songwriting and song cycles flourished during the 19th century. In Germany, composers such as Robert Schumann, Johannes Brahms, and Hugo Wolf produced a substantial body of work. The French, too, began to explore the form. Less dramatic than German song and more inclined to sensitive lyricism, its greatest exponents were Henri Dupart, Gabriel Fauré, and later Claude Debussy. In Russia, the outstanding songwriter was Modest Mussorgsky. Among the legacies left by Schubert was that in his Lieder, he made the piano and the voice equal partners. If there was one instrument in particular that romantic composers felt was their own, it was the piano. Towards the end of the previous century, the piano had superseded the harpsichord as the keyboard instrument. Pianos were more strongly built and could be hit with greater power. They were also, as they developed, capable of subtle expression. They provided, on their own, a miniature orchestra, and romantic composers, many of them virtuoso players themselves, sought in their writing to explore all the instrument's possibilities, whether accompanying songs or being featured as a solo instrument in its own right. Piano pieces poured out, some based on dance forms, such as the waltz, the mazurka, or the polonaise. Others were given evocative titles like romanza, ballade, nocturne, fantasy, or impromptu. So in love with the keyboard were the romantics that pieces which simply exploited technique, études, or studies, became extremely popular. Hardly a single romantic composer did not write for the piano. Here is a rondo by Frédéric Chopin, the archetypal romantic, written when the composer was 15 and published as his Opus 1. Thank you. Chopin was born near Warsaw in 1810 and died in Paris 39 years later. A talented child, he was largely self-taught, publishing his first pieces at the age of 7 and being, like Mozart, trailed around the salons of the rich as a pianist. His father, a teacher of French, made sure he went on to the Warsaw Conservatoire for a more formal musical education. When Chopin was 21 and on a concert tour, Warsaw fell to the Russians and he decided to settle in Paris, where he quickly became a fashionable figure. But his health was never robust, and during his 10-year affair with the masterful novelist Georges Sand, he gave up concert appearances to concentrate on composition. By the time he and Sand broke up, he was mentally exhausted and fatally ill, and he did not live long afterwards. Almost all Chopin's music was written for solo piano, but he also wrote 2 piano concertos as well. His music has always been loved by pianists and by audiences ever since it was first heard, not just because it allows virtuoso pianists to show off, but because Chopin makes the piano sing. Despite living so much of his adult life in France, Chopin never forgot his Polish roots. Polish dance rhythms in particular are to be found in his mazurkas and polonaises. Chopin's Polonaise in A major, written in about 1840 and dedicated to a friend at the Warsaw Conservatoire who had fled Poland following an abortive uprising and also settled for a time in Paris. If Chopin symbolized the fiery aspirations of Polish nationalism, his German contemporary, Robert Schumann, spoke for the more domestic virtues. Much of Schumann's music is autobiographical. Born in Zwickau in Saxony in 1810, Schumann was supposed to become a lawyer, but instead of studying law, he studied the music of Bach and Beethoven. He also took piano lessons with Friedrich Wieck, father of a child prodigy, Clara. Hopes of Schumann becoming an outstanding player were dashed when he injured his hand permanently by using a mechanical device to strengthen his fingers. Fortunately, the injury did not stop him composing, and his earliest pieces were reveling in rhythmic complexities and exploiting the piano's sonorities. The Merry Peasant, one of 43 pieces Schumann wrote in 1848 for young players, especially for the 2 eldest of his own 4 children. Schumann had married Clara, herself a composer of some distinction, 8 years earlier, against the wishes of her father. He had opposed the match because of Schumann's lack of money, his excessive drinking, and his mental instability, something he had inherited from his father. A sister drowned herself, and he too attempted suicide. Eventually, following legal action against her father, they were married, and in his newfound domestic bliss, he turned first to songwriting, then to orchestral works, completing 4 symphonies, a piano concerto, a number of chamber pieces, and his cello concerto. After another attempt to kill himself, Schumann was confined to an asylum, where he died in 1856. Here is part of his cello concerto. The Romantic ideal, in which the artist was as important as the form, meant that composers looked not just inwards for inspiration, but to the places where they were born. The 19th century was a period of revolution, when nationalism was in the air, and the map of Europe as we know it today was starting to take shape. Although there had been regional variations previously, particularly in dance forms, they'd been like accents on a common tongue. Now, composers sought to express in music what was happening in politics, and to give their countries an individual voice. That meant, generally, turning to folk culture. So we can hear in their music that Chopin was Polish, for example, that Schumann was German, and that Smetana and Dvorak were Bohemian. Slavonic Dance No. 1 in C Major by Antonín Dvořák. Dvořák's ability to write catchy melodies, to produce music that is both lyrical and poetic, as well as overflowing with life, has made him deservedly popular. The son of a village publican and butcher, he was born just outside Prague in 1841 and died there 62 years later. He earned his living for 9 years playing the viola in the Prague National Theatre Orchestra, formed by Smetana, composing prolifically in his spare time, but not showing the results to any but his closest friends. However, a patriotic cantata, written in 1873, gave him the impetus to give up his orchestral job and become a full-time composer and teacher. His early works showed an influence of Wagner, but once he had embraced full-time composition, Dvořák began to incorporate more of his native Bohemia's music into his own, especially dances such as the polka and the furient. Dvořák wrote 9 operas, largely on Czech themes, concertos, 8 notable string quartets, considerable chamber music, 6 big choral works, songs, and 9 symphonies. Brahms, who helped him find a publisher when he was just starting out, was also an influence. But it was Czech music that inspired Dvořák most, and his Slavonic dances which made his name in Europe. When he went to America to take up the directorship of the New York Conservatory, he urged American composers to look to their folk roots in order to produce a truly American music, not based on European traditions. And to show them what he meant, he wrote his 9th and final symphony, incorporating tunes he heard in the New World. Dvořák's 9th Symphony, from the New World. In Norway, too, a composer was doing his best to create a national school. This was Edvard Grieg, who was born in Bergen in 1843 and died there in 1907. Grieg was not the first nationalist composer in Scandinavia by any means, but he was the first to make a real impact on a wider European audience. He, too, belonged to the European tradition, having studied in Leipzig. But on his return home, he met and was heavily influenced by Richard Nordraak, writer of the Norwegian national anthem, and became an advocate for Norwegian culture, Norway then being under the rule of Sweden. In particular, Grieg's Norwegian folk song. Here is Wedding Day at Trolldhagen, orchestrated by the composer from a lyric piece he wrote for the piano in 1897. Grieg put on concerts of Norwegian music, planned to set up a Norwegian academy, set poems by Norwegian writers, and wrote the incidental music for plays, including, in 1876, a production of Ibsen's Peer Gynt. He wrote much for the piano, frequently arranging his orchestral pieces for one or two hands. He wrote almost 150 solo songs, a number of works for choirs, chamber music, and the work which brought him and Norway musical recognition throughout the world, the Piano Concerto in A Minor. French composers, too, were developing their own musical language. Gounod, Lalo, Delibes, Chabrier, Massenet among them. One of the most outstanding was César Franck, Belgian-born but a resident of Paris, who brought a seriousness to the French love of effect. Franck was the son of a banker who loved music. Determined his son would receive a good musical education, he sent him to the Paris Conservatoire, where young César picked up several prizes. A devout Catholic, he became a church organist with a reputation for improvisation. His compositions received little notice or acclaim, but he managed to collect around him a number of pupils who revered him, chief of them being Vincent d'Indy. Franck's first real compositional success came with his string quartet, performed when he was 68. Sadly, the following month, on his way to give a lesson, he was struck by a horse-drawn omnibus and died. The music he left behind includes a symphony, symphonic variations, chamber works including the violin sonata, and three sets of organ pieces, all of which possess a distinctive French romantic style. In Russia, following the example set by Glinka, a nationalist movement was formed by the group known as the Mighty Handful, or the Five. Led by Mili Balakirev, they were Rimsky-Korsakov, Borodin, Kui, and Mussorgsky. All the Mighty Handful, with the exception of Balakirev, who came from the landed gentry, started their professional lives, and some even continued, outside music. They were all originally amateur composers. Kui was an army officer who became a general. Rimsky-Korsakov wrote part of his first symphony while on duty in Gravesend as a Russian naval officer. Mussorgsky was first in the army, then a civil servant. Borodin was a medical man and professor of chemistry who founded a school of medicine for women. They all shared a common goal in wanting to create a nationalist school of music, utilizing folk melodies and, in their operas, nationalist themes as they tried to break with Italian tradition and produce music that reflected their national temperament. Their music is as large and as expansive as the country. It contains the rhythms of a people that are a mix of East and West. It can also contain an underlying sadness and nostalgia, a sense of longing. Here is one of the Polovtsian dances Borodin wrote for his unfinished opera, Prince Igor. Throughout the 19th century, the orchestra underwent several changes, the most significant of which was an increase in size. Berlioz had shown how to write for orchestras, and Romantic composers had eagerly taken up the challenge. No longer were they writing for the forces that happened to be around. When Mozart was commissioned to write an orchestral piece, he would have to make do with the players who were available. During the Romantic period, the orchestra became an entity within itself, and composers were writing for a predetermined number of instruments in their various sections of strings, woodwind, brass, and percussion. The symphony, the symphonic poem, the concert overture, and the concerto all became important vehicles for expressing romantic ideas. One of the people who helped develop the symphonic poem was Franz Liszt. Liszt was born in Hungary in 1811. He was a pianist who dazzled all Europe and wrote numerous piano pieces which extended the instrument's range enormously. He was an energetic champion of other composers, became an abbé, and his appetite for women assumed almost legendary status. He was taught the piano by his father, gave his first concert at the age of 9, and then went to study with Czerny in Vienna before moving to Paris. He spent 12 years in France, absorbing the music of Berlioz and Chopin, among others, before eloping with a countess when he was still only 24. He then embarked on a triumphant career as a soloist, writing pieces to show off his brilliance. Abandoning his wife for a princess, he settled in Weimar, where he was appointed musical director of the court, and set about restoring the arts to their previous eminence. For the orchestra there, he wrote a series of symphonic poems, as well as his first piano concerto, which made history by being the first to use a solo triangle. He also wrote the Dante Symphony and the Faust Symphony, which followed Beethoven's lead in having a choral finale. The Faust Symphony tells a story. It's possible to sit with a synopsis and hear the story unfold. This dramatic unity was something that composers writing more conventional symphonies also wanted. But because the Romantic composer was more personally involved with his material than in previous generations, they felt free to interpret the ideal somewhat loosely. Anton Bruckner, for example, took the Schubertian tradition of symphonic writing, that's where melody takes over from formal musical ideas, a stage further. His symphonies are, by comparison, vast and leisurely. Not for nothing have they been called cathedrals of sound. Bruckner was born in Upper Austria in 1824 and died in Vienna in 1896. He came from poor peasant stock and was a devout Catholic. The village organist and schoolmaster, he wore baggy trousers, deliberately too short to give his legs more freedom while playing the organ, and collars that were too large. He was extremely naive, once giving a tip to the conductor Hans Richter at the end of a rehearsal for one of his symphonies. And he so revered Wagner that he would never sit in his presence. At their first meeting, he actually fell on his knees. Through his organ playing, he was a particularly good improviser, Bruckner became the organist of Linz Cathedral before moving to Vienna and working at the conservatory. He worked slowly and studied hard. Although he wrote several choral works and a mass, he was over 40 before he attempted his first symphony. He completed 8 in all, his 9th being unfinished. Bruckner helped advance symphonic form by introducing extra subjects into the exposition, merging the development into the recapitulation, and building up the finale by using elements of previous movements. Bruckner's Fourth Symphony. Like Bruckner, Johannes Brahms was another composer who did not write his first symphony until he was over 40. It seems strange now, but 50 years ago, his symphonies were considered difficult, and his violin concerto, one of the most popular in the repertoire, as almost unplayable. Brahms was born in Hamburg in 1833 and was a gifted pianist. He supported himself in his early days by playing in bars, an experience which, it's thought, caused his disillusionment with women. Throughout his life, he remained a confirmed bachelor. Befriended by Robert and Clara Schumann, with whom he was in love, he wrote typically romantic piano works. A large number of chamber pieces, and both the German Requiem and Alto Rhapsody, before embarking on his first symphony. He felt inhibited by the achievements of Beethoven, and it was to take him almost 20 years to complete. Symphonic writing had gone in two directions: the Beethoven way, which involved the logical development of musical themes and material, and the Mendelssohnian or Schubertian way, in which tunes were more important than ideas, in which development is frequently used not as an end in itself, but as a way of bridging the gaps between one good tune and another. Brahms, especially in his first symphony, managed, consciously or unconsciously, to fuse the two traditions. The first movement of Brahms' First Symphony. Once he'd finished it, Brahms immediately wrote a second, followed by the violin concerto, which he dedicated to Joachim, the second piano concerto, and the third and fourth symphonies. He died in Vienna in 1897. The large-scale romantic symphony reached its pinnacle in the writing of Gustav Mahler. Mahler was born in 1860, in Bohemia. The son of a Jewish shopkeeper, he He studied in Vienna, where he was advised to concentrate on composition and conducting. He was chosen by Anton Bruckner to make a two-piano transcription of his Third Symphony. Their arrangement was that Bruckner would provide the beer, Mahler the rolls and butter, but the penniless Mahler would often turn up empty-handed. It was from Bruckner that Mahler learnt to think symphonically on a vast scale. He was always very single-minded about the works he wanted to write. On the one hand, there were the symphonies, large-scale works which were autobiographical, intellectual, and the musical equivalent of Nietzsche's philosophical writings. On the other, possibly influenced by Hugo Wolf, with whom he shared lodgings in Vienna, the equally autobiographical but smaller-scale songs and song cycles. Sometimes the two met, as in the cycle Das Lied von der Erde, which is really a symphony, and his Eighth Symphony, the Symphony of a Thousand, which calls for three sopranos, two contraltos, a tenor, baritone, bass, double choir, and boys' choir. Here is part of the first movement of Das Lied von der Erde, the Song of the Earth, first performed after Mahler's death in 1911. Mahler always wanted to be a composer, but not having a private income and having grand musical ideas no one wanted to commission, he had to earn a living by conducting. By the time he was 25, he was one of the leading operatic conductors of his day. His principal appointment was 10 years at the Vienna Opera House, where his belief in the importance of a cohesive music theatre bringing together all elements of staging produced what is still considered by many to be a golden age. He had a waspish tongue, and anyone who did not meet his exacting standards was quickly dispensed with. For the rest of his life, until he died tragically young, aged only 50, Mahler spent 9 months of every year conducting and his summer holidays composing, mostly at the lakeside retreat he had built especially on the edge of the Austrian Alps. Mahler's symphonies were autobiographical. "My whole life is contained in them," he once wrote. "I have set down in them my experience and my suffering." A Jew in a world that was becoming increasingly hostile, so that he converted to Catholicism, Mahler lived until 1911, the brink of the First World War that was to tear Europe apart. And that sense of a loss of order, of yearning for the past while searching for a future, is very much a part of his symphonic output. He used every nuance of the symphonic language available to him, especially the techniques of harmonization created by Wagner. Like Wagner, he used progressive tonality, where a piece moves to its own natural conclusion rather than having to return to a home key. This gave rise to a Mahlerian ending where the music just dies away as if to say that life is meaningless. He went further and introduced an orchestral palette that had never been used before, writing for instruments that were not common in orchestras, such as the mandolin. He made conventional instruments play in unfamiliar and awkward registers, removing their sound from that customarily heard. He introduced acoustic effects, such as bands off stage, and incorporated snatches of untransformed popular music. Mahler is rightly regarded as the last of the great Viennese symphonists. Thank you. The Adagietto from Mahler's Fifth Symphony. Another orchestral form, which appealed immensely to Romantic composers, was the concert overture. Mendelssohn's Hebrides Overture, written after his boat trip to see Fingal's Cave on the Isle of Staffa, is a good example of the genre. One of the most popular of all 19th century concert overtures is Tchaikovsky's Romeo and Juliet Fantasy Overture, written in 1869 when the composer was 29. The love theme from Tchaikovsky's Romeo and Juliet Fantasy Overture. Pyotr Ilyich Tchaikovsky was born in 1840 in Votkinsk, some 400 miles to the east of Moscow, where his father was an inspector of mines. His mother was the granddaughter of a French émigré. When he was 8, the family moved to St. Petersburg, where Tchaikovsky suffered the first of his nervous breakdowns and was forbidden even to play the piano, his only real pleasure in life. Sent to boarding school, a separation from his mother that hit him hard and was compounded when she died of cholera 2 years later, he turned more and more to music for consolation. After graduating from law school, he joined the civil service, but was advised by the principal of the St. Petersburg Conservatoire, where he had enrolled as a part-time student, to concentrate on music. At the age became a professor of harmony at the newly established Moscow Conservatoire and began composing seriously, but initially with little success. In 1877, while writing his opera Eugene Onegin about a man who rejects love until it's too late, Tchaikovsky contracted a disastrous marriage to please his family and possibly to convince himself and show the world that he was not homosexual. Within 2 months he attempted to commit suicide by standing in a river, and he and his wife soon separated. The following year Tchaikovsky resigned from the conservatoire to concentrate on composition, helped by the arrival in his life of Nadezhda von Meck, a 46-year-old widow who had commissioned him to arrange some of his smaller pieces for violin and piano. She became his patron for the next 14 years, but on one condition, that they never met. It was under her patronage that he composed much of his finest music, including the Fourth Symphony, which he dedicated to her. Swan Lake, Sleeping Beauty, the opera The Queen of Spades, and the Fifth Symphony. Tchaikovsky died in 1893, a few days after conducting the premiere of his Sixth Symphony. According to the official version, he died from cholera, contracted by drinking contaminated water in a restaurant. But the latest research indicates he may have committed suicide as a result of his homosexuality being about to be made public. We will probably never know the truth. Certainly, the Sixth Symphony is a work of intense despair. Part of the fourth movement of Tchaikovsky's Sixth Symphony in B minor, the Pathétique. In addition to writing symphonic and ballet music, Tchaikovsky also wrote notable concertos for the piano and violin. The 19th century saw the emergence of virtuoso performers who could sell concert tickets on their names alone. Paganini and Joachim spring immediately to mind. The growth in public concerts made the concerto a natural showcase for both composers and soloists. Under the Romantics, the polite conversations of the Mozartian concerto gave way to fiery expression, to a battle, almost, between the instruments of the orchestra and the soloist. The third and final movement of Mendelssohn's Violin Concerto in E minor, written in the summer of 1844 for the leader of the Leipzig Orchestra. Felix Mendelssohn was born in Hamburg in 1809, into a well-off, intellectually distinguished family. He was a gifted artist, writer, and linguist, besides being a prodigy as a musician. And yet musically, his earlier works far outshine his later pieces. And by the time he died in 1847, aged only 38, he was, to some extent, worn out. During the 19th century, more and more ordinary people wanted to sing, and so large choral societies were formed. These were strictly amateur, and they had to have something to sing, and so composers began to write works for them. These had to be easy enough for amateurs to sing, and so were firmly rooted in the oratorio tradition of Handel. Many of these huge choral works were written on biblical texts, but they were far removed from the religious music of a century earlier. A work like Mendelssohn's Elijah, commissioned for the 1846 Birmingham Triennial Festival, may have had a biblical subject, but it was a piece for the concert hall, not for the church. Even a more specifically liturgical work, such as Brahms' German Requiem, is a concert piece in all but name. Doch mich. Lord, make me to know my end. From Brahms' German Requiem, written following the death of his mother in 1865, and first performed 3 years later, in 1868. By the time Verdi came to write his Requiem in 1873, only 5 years later, it even sounds distinctly operatic, hardly surprising, perhaps, since part of it's taken from his opera Don Carlos. Opera was a form that appealed to the Romantic composer because it allowed him to express feelings in music. As with other musical forms, however, it's difficult to trace a direct line because so much was going on in various places simultaneously. At the start of the 19th century, Italian operas still reigned supreme, and the man who provided the bridge between the classical and the Romantic periods was Gioachino Rossini. Rossini was born in Pesaro in 1792. His father was a horn player in a theatre band, his mother a small-time singer. He was taught both to sing and play the horn, and also to play the piano and cello. His early works, written while still in his teens, were farces, and already he was employing the device of building excitement by having a long crescendo on a repeated phrase. Although he's best known for his comic operas, Rossini also wrote serious works, and was soon in much demand throughout Italy, leading to an engagement to provide 2 operas a year for Naples. In 1816, his masterpiece, The Barber of Seville, the oldest opera by an Italian composer never to have disappeared from the repertoire, was first. Like many established and popular operas, it had a disastrous first night. Here, in Act Two, Don Basilio is convinced he has scarlet fever.
Cosa? Ecco quale intoppo!
Oh no!
Come qua! Servitor, servitor di tutti quanti!
Aspetta questa barba benedetta, la facciamo sì o no? Questa barba la facciamo sì o no?
Ora vengo, ora vengo.
During Rossini's career, the center of operatic development moved for a time from Italy to Paris, and Rossini moved there too. The events of the French Revolution led to a vogue for spectacular operas with last-minute escapes, massive crowd scenes, and an interest in historical characters. This new form, of which Gaspare Spontini and Luigi Cherubini were pioneers, became known as grand opera. For Paris, Rossini wrote, amongst others, Le Comte Henri, and his last work, William Tell. This was firmly in the grand opera tradition, and was supposed to have been the first of five operas he was contracted to write, but the king's abdication and the 1830 revolution put an end to the plan, and he never wrote another opera, even though he lived a further 40 years. Quite why he suddenly abandoned operatic composition is not known. Early grand opera reached a climax in the work of Giacomo Meyerbeer, who succeeded Rossini as Paris's favourite composer. Born into a wealthy Jewish family in Berlin in 1791, Meyerbeer's operas were spectacular, epic tales, with melodramatic effects and effective scores which gave the public what they wanted. Although now considered second division, his work influenced, to greater or lesser degrees, such composers as Verdi, Wagner, Gounod and Massenet. This is the Coronation March from Meyerbeer's The Prophet, first produced in 1849. While grand opera was flourishing in Paris, in Italy a new form was being developed, known as bel canto. Italian opera of the previous period had relied heavily on vocal display and pyrotechnics. Vincenzo Bellini brought to perfection a new school of singing, the bel canto, which literally means beautiful singing, but is now almost always applied to the operas of people like him and Donizetti. The difference between previous vocal lines and Bellini's lies not in their complexity. Although his lines are less florid, they can be fiendishly difficult to sing. But that Bellini was the first Italian composer to match the emotion in the music to the characterization. Singers were expected to act as well as sing. Bellini was born in Sicily in 1801 and studied at the Naples Conservatory. He died young. He was only 33 when he contracted dysentery. He left 10 operas, of which Norma, La Sonnambula and I Puritani are the best known, having provided vehicles for such recent illustrious singers as Maria Callas and Joan Sutherland. In I Puritani, set in Plymouth in Devon, Elvira, daughter of the Puritan Lord Walton, is in love with the royalist Lord Talbot. Her father holds the Queen prisoner, and when Talbot helps the Queen escape, wearing Elvira's bridal veil, Elvira goes mad. She sings the aria, Qui la voce sua suave.
Thank you.
had an enormous influence upon both Berlioz and Chopin, who was a close friend and was much admired by Wagner. His great rival in Italy was Donizetti. In 25 years, Gaetano Donizetti produced nearly 70 operas, sometimes three or four in a year. He worked incredibly fast. The one-act farce, Il Campanello, was knocked off, libretto as well as music, in only 9 days. Donizetti also found time to write 12 string quartets, 7 masses, cantatas, piano music, motets, songs, and other bits and pieces. Working at such speed and in such quantity, not everything he produced could be of the highest quality, and some of his music does have a by-the-yard feel to it. The son of a weaver turned pawnbroker, he was born in Bergamo in 1797, and was always determined to be an opera composer. His first success came in 1818, when he was 21, with a comedy written in the style of Rossini. Donizetti was a man of the theatre. His ability to provide a setting in which singers could shine helped make his operas popular both with artists and with audiences, and three of them, Lucia di Lammermoor, Don Pasquale, and L'Elisir d'Amore, remain great favourites today. In L'Elisir d'Amore, the simple Nemorino, who is in love with Adina, is fooled into buying a magic potion, which will make him irresistible to women. It is, in reality, no wine. In Una furtiva lagrima, one furtive tear, he tells Adina that he would rather die than live without her. While the Italian operatic tradition was moving into either grand opera or bel canto, there was a movement going on in France which was to have a significant impact on opera in the years ahead. This was the development of a light, comic opera tradition as exemplified in the works of Daniel Auber and Louis Hérold. What they pioneered eventually went in two directions, one towards a French lyric opera in which names such as Charles Gounod, Jules Massenet, and Saint-Saëns feature large. The other towards operetta. Jacques Offenbach, the man who made French operetta, wrote more than 90 theatre pieces. With their wit, sparkling tunes, deft orchestration, and their sometimes trenchant social comment, they became the rage of Paris. The Can-Can, from Offenbach's Orpheus in the Underworld. Offenbach paved the way for the operettas of such composers as Johann Strauss, and in England, the satirical operas of Gilbert and Sullivan. Their work, in turn, helped lead to the establishment this century of the Broadway musical. It was the opera comique, the building of that name as well as the form, which was to produce a work which was to affect Italian opera greatly. In 1872, Georges Bizet was commissioned to write a new piece for the theatre. He decided, against advice and considerable opposition, to set Prosper Mérimée's novella about Carmen, a gypsy with whom Don José, an army corporal, falls madly in love, deserting the nice girl next door along the way. Because of the theatre for which it was written, Bizet followed the conventions of opera comique, mixing brilliant choral numbers with spoken dialogue, incorporating the obligatory dance routine and giving the music a Spanish feel. He also used repeated motifs, as Wagner had done. In Act Two, Set in the inn to which Don José has gone, having served his sentence for allowing Carmen to escape, Escamillo, the toreador, is heard going past on his way to a bullfight in Seville and is invited in. The two strands of opera begun earlier in the century, bel canto and grand opera, together with elements of realism as found in Bizet's Carmen, reached their culmination in the operas of the Italian composer Giuseppe Verdi. He combined dramatic realism with Italian lyricism. Pensiero, the chorus of the Hebrew slaves from Nabucco, Verdi's third opera and the one that made his name. Verdi was born in 1813, the son of an innkeeper and shop owner. He became an organist and composer in his teens, but was turned down by the Milan Conservatoire for being over age and insufficiently gifted. He was determined not to give up and carried on his studies privately. His first opera, Oberto, was produced at La Scala when he was 27. By the time he was 40, he had written Rigoletto, La Traviata, and Il Trovatore. His final opera, Falstaff, was produced in 1893, when he was 80. First and foremost, it was the red-bloodedness of his music that appealed, the warmth of his lyricism, his perfect dramatic timing, and his ability to draw intense human relationships, often between fathers and daughters. His music is the highest point of Italian opera.
La donna è mobile, qual piuma al vento, muta l'accento, e di pensiero, sempre un amabile, leggiadro viso, in pianto il viso, e per la donna è mobile, qual piuma al vento, muta l'accento.
La Donna è Mobile, Women are Fickle, from Rigoletto. All the characters in Verdi's later operas are recognizable human beings with recognizable human emotions, not that far removed from ordinary members of the audience. This sense of realism, exploited to such effect by Bizet and Carmen, reached its fulfillment in the Verismo, or realism operas of Mascagni, Leoncavallo, and especially of Puccini. Giacomo Puccini was born in 1858 and died in Brussels before. But although he lived well into this century, his work was rooted firmly in the last. He came from a musical family, studied in Milan, where his teacher was Ponchielli, composer of La Gioconda, and had his first opera, the one-act Le Villi, produced when he was 26. Puccini was not a fast worker, and with the exception of Edgar and La Rondine, everything he wrote was a success. When he died, his wealth was estimated at being $4 million. Puccini was a master craftsman. He knew exactly what he was doing in the theatre, and that, allied to his gift for heart-tugging melody, has made his operas among the most performed and popular of all time. the closing moments of Act I of Puccini's La Bohème. The national characteristics that had found their way increasingly into orchestral music during the Romantic period were also being utilized in opera. In Russia, the mighty handful were writing nationalistic operas based invariably on historical figures or legends, such as Mussorgsky's Boris Godunov. In what was to become Czechoslovakia, Smetana and Dvořák were also writing nationalistic operas. But it was in Germany that nationalism was to have the most profound effect upon opera as a whole. The first great nationalist German operatic composer was Karl Maria von Weber. Weber was born in 1786, and he was just 40 when he died in 1826. Before Weber, there was very little German opera. Mozart had written The Magic Flute and The Abduction from the Harem in German, but all his other major works had been in Italian. There was also Beethoven's Fidelio, but that was about it. Then in 1821 came Weber's Der Freischütz, a story about a hunter who uses magic bullets. It's a highly dramatic, poetic subject, based on a German legend, and involves the supernatural and the symbolic. Together with Weber's gift for melody and his exciting orchestration, this became a seminal work, establishing with one performance a German opera. Some historians have even dated the start of the Romantic movement from that June evening in Berlin when it was first staged. Chorus from Der Freischütz by Weber. It's easy to hear why the opera should have had such an influence upon Wagner, because The Ring is based on exactly the same ideas. Many of Weber's ideas predate Wagner's by 30 years or more. There are strange harmonies. He too wanted to create music theatre. Wagner was, arguably, the most important of all the Romantic composers, for few, if any, single composers have had such a profound influence on the course of their art. Richard Wagner was born in Leipzig in 1813. It was seeing Weber conduct Der Freischütz when he was 9 that first turned him towards music. Hearing Beethoven's symphonies and opera Fidelio soon afterwards decided him that he would be a composer. By the time he was 22, he had written 2 operas and was the conductor of a small opera house. And even if others didn't know it, he knew he was destined for greatness. He bought himself the first of many notebooks to write a daily entry to help him when he came to write his autobiography. His first success was Rienzi. But being short of money, he and his first wife, Minna, had to flee from Germany to escape his creditors. Later in his career, after working at the Royal Opera in Dresden, he was forced to escape to Switzerland, after supporting an abortive revolution against his employer. There he conceived the idea of a music drama involving a synthesis of all the arts, which was to lead to the writing of The Ring, Tristan und Isolde, and Der Meistersinger, the only comic opera he ever wrote. Tristan und Isolde was a revolutionary work inspired by his passionate love for Mathilde Wesendonck, the wife of his host in Switzerland, a passion which was probably unconsummated. Completed in 1859, it pushed Wagner's symphonic ideas to the limit and incorporated harmonic innovations which were to pave the way for Mahler and Schoenberg. Wagner developed a unique orchestral sound. Debussy described the orchestration of Parsifal, his last work written in 1882, as lit from behind. Several elements go to make up the Wagner sound. One is the use of chords made up of homogeneous sounds. Another, the way in which sounds merge into each other, so that the texture of the music is constantly shifting. There is always a forward movement to the music as dissonance resolves into dissonance. The colour of Wagner's music is unique, although he was not the first to experiment with harmonic sounds. He owed much to the pioneering work of Mozart, Spohr, Schumann and Liszt. Liszt in particular, who was to become his father-in-law when he married Cosima, was an enormous influence. And of course, he could write wonderful, inspiring melodies, such as the Pilgrim's Chorus from Tannhäuser.